you know, of course you don't want to fall, but is that the goal of sport climbing, to not fall? No, the goal of sport climbing is to get to the top. There's already kind of an example there of focusing on the pressure of not falling versus the goal, the focus of how do I get to the top, right? There's an offensive mentality here and a defensive mentality here, and it's important to focus on the offensive mentality.
Hey, welcome to the Test Piece Podcast. This podcast is about all things high-level climbing. My name's Joshua Horsley. I've been climbing for 25 years, and I love staying at the cutting edge of climbing.
Hi, my name is Timothy Kang. I'm a pro climber, a coach, and a route setter, and climbing is my life.
We started the podcast to explore and articulate what it takes to climb at a high level, what it takes to go from good to great. Okay, let's start the podcast.
All right, Tim, my dude, how's it going, man?
Josh, what's up? It's going good. Got my one day back in Salt Lake City.
Yeah, I don't like, I mean, I love you getting to travel and everything, but it definitely makes like the podcast recording difficult where I'm like, what's that background? What time zone are you in? And then we have to like compress. People don't know this, but this is our third podcast this week, dude. Did you realize?
Yeah. That? Yeah, I mean, yeah, it's hard. It's hard to, for you guys, man, I'm trying to drop these or do enough so we have something to drop weekly, but I realistically cannot film or record a podcast every week. But yeah, we did a lot of podcasts lately. And, but yeah, I think it's good to just, you know, try. Like, I think the biggest thing that I love having you as a partner, Josh, is how you're just like, let's try, dude, let's try to make it good and then try to make it consistent. I'm like, all right, okay, cool, let's try. And it works out. I think it works out really well.
Consistency, dude. Showing up each day with intention. Just going to use that as a little segue into the last podcast we did. We did one with Carlo. And goddamn, it was a banger. It was so good. You guys.
That was my favorite one.
Yeah.
I think that was my favorite one.
I think me too. We can always tell. I mean, we can tell when a podcast is good when we end it and we're just happy and psyched. And then when you have a guest come on and they're happy and psyched at the end too, you just know that was a fun time, and I think it comes through. So yeah, if you're listening to this and you haven't listened to that one, you probably just stop this one and go listen to Carlo first.
Yeah, Carlo is the man. He is the professional. He's someone that I've looked up to for a really long time, and especially signing on as a global pro this year for Black Diamond, he's like the guy that you kind of look up to and you're like, okay, what has worked for you, like all these things. And especially just going on a trip with him, you know, for a week in Italy, I learned a lot more about him, heard a lot more stories, and I was like, wow, this guy's like super legit and real. And that's hard to find in climbing, right? Because we all kind of blur together. Like, everyone climbs hard, you know, a lot of climbers climb hard, and like but there's a difference between being professional about it. And so if you want to know what I'm talking about, just go listen to the podcast. He was fantastic.
Yeah, Carlo stood out as someone who can articulate his thoughts. There's a lot of high-end climbers that are great climbers, but I feel like sometimes they don't quite understand what they're doing, or they can't share it in a meaningful way. It's probably just more through lack of trying, you know. they're so focused on what they're doing, but Carlo just really was able to be present, share you know, how he got to, you know, such a high level. And because of that, I got to highlight some of the things that I took away, man, because it's, you know, we love sharing guys like Carlo and sharing his story, but I don't know about you, but it's like really helpful for me too. Like I take a lot away from it. So, I wanted to share a couple of my notes that just stood out to me. I think this is a theme here, and we had a freaking whole podcast on this, but mastering climbing, right? Like, Carlo really emphasized this mastering climbing. And I think that the important thing there is that it's key for long-term success, right? Like, you might be able to sit under a boulder that's your style and, you know, sit under there for a whole season, train, and, you know, reach, you know, two grades above what you've ever done. And you're just like, wow, like I did a V hard. But that's not really what makes someone a great climber. And it's not really what lets you then go to the next boulder, you know, maybe on a different type of rock around the world and have success there too. And just this idea of mastering climbing was something that came out when we talked to him. And we know he didn't listen to that podcast of ours. So that was just Carlo being Carlo. But you can see it in his tick list, right? So Carlo is an amazing boulderer. And I would say just that is kind of what makes him kind of the pinnacle. You know, when you think of the different disciplines he does, he really is one of the top boulderers that we've ever seen in America. But that trad climbing, that ability to climb 14 plus trad climbing, those are connected, right? Like his ability to boulder a high level is not somehow separate from his ability to climb these more technical climbs at a high level as well. And, you know, I've said this before where pros kind of don't have big holes in their ability. So maybe Carlo is well known as a dynamic, powerful climber, kind of was a big, guy in the pogo. I don't know if you remember when like he really brought that pogo as a skill to bouldering. I'm not saying he invented the moon kick or the pogo, but man, did he take it to another level. But I guarantee you that he just crushes static movement, body tension, and you can just see from his technical chops on Yosemite Slab that his footwork on low angle is incredible as well. And so, you know, those things build into each other, right? And that's just a reminder to me, like, don't get too caught up in, you know, what you're really good at. Play the long game, find those weaknesses, master everything. And that will really be the thing that builds that pyramid to let you reach higher and higher peaks.
Yeah, no, I love that. I'm not even going to try to echo because that was just so well said. But, you know, one thing that really got me there also was kind of just the reflection of my approach in my climbing, and, you know, just seeing it kind of validated and made sense is super, super cool for me. And I have a very different process, of course, for me personally as a climber and how I coach and things. And it was just cool to see it kind of balanced by his aggressive approach to implement in himself for the last two decades, you know? And, you know, yeah, big thing that really, you know, he's climbed outside a lot more than I ever have, but a lot of my time has been spent in competition and a lot of the approaches are the same, mostly because the thought of mastery is so to allow you to perform whenever you want to, right? Like no matter what factors are there, acknowledge certain factors, but you're there to perform. So how do you perform? You work through mastery, not so much the performance in the moment, which, you know, is what we're going to be talking about today. But, you know, the idea of performing at your potential capabilities all the time is mostly through mastery. And seeing that, hearing that kind of broken down, deconstructed, and how he does that, and, you know, what he's looked for and what he finds important to maintain those things is really important, because, you know, competitions are kind of the classic, okay, it's, you know, 100 guys doing the same four boulders or whatever, and whoever stands out on top is the winner. But, you know, it's more so than the actual abilities that day. It's how people interact with those factors and the obstacles and how you're feeling in that exact moment, not so much what you're capable of, right? And I think that's what the whole, you know, you guys went back and forth about this, like, but who actually shows up and does it, right? Who actually gets it done? Who's a doer, right? And like he was really good about being like, this is how I was a doer, and this is why it's important to do that. I loved it.
That's a great little teaser on today's topic. We're going to be talking about performance under stress. But saying that, I can't leave Carlo for just another moment, because it's just too good. And I can't believe we didn't even talk about him as a competitor. Like, we kind of like, you know, I did my due diligence, right, by looking at his 8A, and it's like hard boulder, sick FA, like Flex Luther, a meltdown, like all these just amazing climbs. And that's like, oh yeah, he was an incredible comp climber. In fact, he was kind of one of the earlier people to really bring that more dynamic compy style forward. When I think about nationals and what he looked like on the wall back then, he was aggressive and committed to that more dynamic style. And we didn't even talk about that because there was just too much. But I want to highlight what you said about this, you know, who stands at the top of the boulder, who's a doer. And I related that story from his movie Heritage, but I had that in my notes here to talk about today as something that really stood out for me. And it's just so many people have excuses, me included. And Tim, I know, even though you execute so often,
me included as well. You got it.
But yeah, you can't really let those, you know, flourish. You gotta, get away from excuses. And I think, Tim, you've helped me in my climbing with that too, where I you know, say, oh, my fingers are weak right now. Oh, I haven't been training. Like, I can't do this climb. And just every time you let that creep in, you cast a vote for yourself of being weak. You cast a vote for yourself in the opposite direction. And Carlo just embodies this mentality of committing and getting it done and not having excuses. And I kind of hinted, or I think we talked a little bit about the story where he, like, you know, was 18 and just moved to Colorado to live in his car, to go climb hard boulders. And he wasn't that great at that point. And I don't know if he had like an inkling inside of him that he was going to be great, but I guarantee you, he wasn't sitting there and, you know, he wasn't at home in Santa Rosa complaining about all the people who were doing it. He you know, took his shot and put it all out there. And I think that is really connected to what we're going to talk about today.
Nice. Awesome.
Should we just get into it? Is that,
let's get into it, man.
Okay. Well, I kind of want you to introduce what you're saying about performance, because the topic for today is performance under pressure. And, you know, some of those scenarios are comps, highballs. Do you know something about comps and highballs, Tim?
Yeah. Have you done that stuff? I know a little bit about those things. Yeah. And you kind of alluded to it, in terms of what Carlo was talking about. And yeah, I mean, let's talk about performance as a whole, right? So, a big thing that, I mean, we could talk about performance and then performance under pressure is, well,
that's
kind of
why
the point
I think
here.
That's the best way to start, yeah. It, right? And that's why I wanted totally. To kick it back to you, because, you know, I said, oh, it's performance under pressure. And you were like, hold on, dude, one second.
Yeah. And we could talk about, you know, performance is already hard, right? Like, everybody is there trying to perform. And I kind of want to go into that as well. Everybody is there trying to perform. Everyone listening right now is there to perform whatever you're trying to do.
So I, you know, I said comps and highballs, and I said how this is something you were really, you know, into, or, you know, really well skilled at. But when I thought about the different scenarios that this applies to, there was flashing at the end of a trip, or actually just even on a trip when you know that you have a finite amount of time. And of course, I said, when you're a sponsored athlete, you know, like, you have to perform. It's your freaking job. But just to tie it into what you were saying is, there's also just like making sure your freaking tries count. You know, like, what are you doing at the gym? There's performing day in and day out, and understanding how to flip that switch that, you know, Carlo talked about. Totally. So yeah, so sorry, I'll talk back to you. Performance. Let's hear
performance.
It.
Performance as a whole. What are you there for? You guys have to ask yourselves that question. Everybody has to ask themselves that question. I don't care if you are a sponsored athlete. I don't care if you have just started climbing. I don't care if you've been climbing for a week. I don't care if you've been climbing for 20 years. You are not entitled to performing. You are there to perform, and you should admit that to yourself every day if that's what you're trying to do. And I'm just going to tell you right now, every client that I ever have had, regardless of what level of climber they are, how long they've been doing it, or, you know, how little they've been doing it, eventually admits themselves that they are there to perform and to increase their level of performance, but also increase their consistency of performance at their level of performance. And so, have you admit to yourself that you are a climber who thrives on development, progression, commitment, and execution? Those things are really, really important. Do you honestly want to develop yourself? Do you honestly like the progression? Do you honestly see the difference between committing to something and not committing to something? And do you see that that ties into your execution of the performance? Performance is one thing, right? If we sit there and we're trying to accomplish something hard, right? We're trying to do maximum set of pull-ups. If we're trying to get on the campus board and do something further than what we did last time, if we're trying to hang a grip more than we've been able to do, that's performance, right? But are you able to make that happen? That's a different side of performance, right? So execution is one side of performance, and the pressure is another thing. Are you able to do those things anyway? Because, okay, fine, you're able to do pull-ups. Can you do that when you're tired after school? Okay, so you haven't had a good breakfast, but it's the day of competition. Can you get over that and perform and execute anyway? So we're talking about the stress now. And then also, my last question in terms of performance as a whole is, have you taken the time to understand what performance at peak ability takes? Recognize what you're willing to give so you can match your expectations. So I want to kind of go into the types of pressure, because, okay, that's performance. And, you know, we're already mentioning that performance already is kind of hard if you want to step into the gym. Yeah, sorry, go ahead.
I just, before you go into those, I just want to emphasize exactly what you're saying. It's what is performance? What are you there for? So just answering that question, because although today we're talking more about how to perform under stress, you know, how to perform in those moments, I when you said, hey, Josh, like you need to first answer, like, what is performance? And one of those questions is what does performance do? What does it look like? What does success look like to you? And I just wanted to, you know, say that I think that was a great place to start, because that helps answer those questions when you deal with the stress, the mental side. And so I just didn't want to gloss over that because, if you don't get that right, if you don't know why you're there or what you're there for or what success looks like to you. And also I love what you said at the end is, do you understand what it takes to perform at a really high level? And that's why the mental aspect, a lot of people think, oh, you mean like do more pull-ups? It's like, no, like, listen to Carlo and how he's like weaker than he used to be, but he's performing at a higher level. And that's something I love that you brought.
Let's clarify that actually. Now that you're talking about it, climbing is complex, right? There's a mental aspect, there's a physical aspect, and there's a technical aspect to performing climbing at a high level, period. Let me say that again. There's a mental aspect, a technical aspect, and a physical aspect to performing climbing at a high level, period. It's something that a lot of climbers at this day and age in this generation, a lot of people who try to do it, don't recognize that. You don't recognize that, okay, you cannot just go to the training room and do your hangboarding. You cannot just go lift weights. You cannot just go do pull-ups. You have to fall on the climb, approach the climb, sequence it, fail, ask yourself what happened, right? Teach yourself techniques, practice stepping on footholds, practice stepping on volumes, practice creating leverage and timing certain things, practice maintaining tension in the wall, practice the technical things, right? I'm a coach. You can ask me questions. I'm here to help with those things. I mean, nowadays I'm busy, but the point is there are coaches out there who can teach you these things, right? Those are things you can learn, technique, mental aspects. You have to practice those things. You have to acknowledge that, okay, there's this one V8 boulder that has this V5 move over and over and over and over again. And at the top, there's this really dicey foot. How do you commit to that? Well, I have to be resilient enough to not be affected by all of the physical things that just happened to me and make decisions, even though I'm tired, right? And those are all the kind of the actual factors of performance, the actual difficulties in performance. And then we can talk about the external factors, right?
Yeah. And this is what's tricky about being a coach. It seems like is when you're talking about these mental things is that they're a little amorphous and this is what I like about what you try to do is bring them into the realm of talking about them, articulating them, and then developing strategies and techniques to address them. Because I have this thing written, like the first thing in my performance under pressure is I have this kind of thing where it's like this je ne sais quoi. Je ne sais quoi means it's a French word for like that for which there is no word that separates the great from the good. It's like you see these people in the gym and you're just like, wow, like this person is burly. Like, wow, they're always like crushing these moves. And then you're like, but they never get anything done. And so it's like, how do you change that? And at first I say, it's this je ne sais quoi that separates the great from the good. But that's what you're doing, Tim, is you're helping us bring that amorphous world of the mental and the practice and put it into words and put into things that we can work on and get better at so that we can figure it out.
Yeah. And maybe this is a good point to talk about, maybe we should do podcasts on performance as a whole, but this is performance under pressure, right? So, we're defining performance and, acknowledging the difficulties of performance, the important factors of allowing you to perform, period, right? But we're talking about performance under pressure today. What is pressure? What kind of pressures exist in life and climbing? And these are really important things, stuff that a lot of the coaches in my life, a lot of what Josh has helped me with, and just talking with my friends, just talking about pressure and, going to competitions and really dissecting these things. So the types of pressure that I recognize in climbing are desires, simple stress. I think desires and stress can actually be kind of a net that, covers a lot of these things, but desires, stress, expectations are a big one. Societal pressure, financial pressure, and then kind of the general effort. So like time, skin, like the investment that you actually have, that can also add pressure. So I don't know what other types of pressure that you had, Josh.
I mean, I told you my kind of like general, comps and highballs and flash. I mean, I think that what it is where we're talking about performance under pressure is instead of just doing something that's performance, which is just like the most massive subject ever, performance under pressure really highlights knowing how to bring your skills together in that moment. And there is that big, I think what makes pressure pressure is the mental component, because if you have no idea what's going on, and then you have easier access to tap into some of your abilities. Or you could say that it's easier to do 10 pull-ups when you're just in the gym versus if you're hanging off the side of a building and you're scared.
Right.
You know, so I think that's really what we're talking about and why we chose that like really narrow idea of performance.
Totally. Before we go into this, I actually had a pro tip. We skipped the pro tips, yeah, going straight into it. And my pro tip is actually probably the reason why it came up was the process from here. The first process I want to talk about was clarity. So my pro tip is to practice meditation. I think in whatever concept, in whatever way anyone wants to practice meditation. I've practiced meditation in many, many different ways. But taking simple, consistent steps to organize your thoughts and allow awareness to come in is so key for optimal performance. Just to put that out there for you guys. I don't think, I haven't meditated in a long time, but I've had simple meditation concepts allow myself to do it on a regular basis, not so much to sit down and do meditative sessions, which I've done in the past. And that really helps me teach myself to meditate. But you can meditate for moments, just small moments in any part of your day. A small practice so I actually used to just follow, I think this app was called Headspace, that I really like to use. And back, it was cheaper back then. I looked at it again recently. It's very expensive, but there are a lot of apps and videos that you can just look up, like just to follow a simple meditation, 30 minutes, 15 minutes, an hour, like whatever you want to do. And another type of meditation that I like to do in competitions, if you guys are competitive folk, I look at the clock. I look at the clock winding down. There's always a clock somewhere to look. And I start counting down and just look at it. I start counting down and then I close my eyes and I try to follow the count. Nothing else. I don't think about anything else. I don't think about anything. I just try to follow the clock. And it's crazy how hard it is. You're following your rhythm. You count. All right, 10, 9, 8, close your eyes, 7, 6, 5. You look up and it says 7. You're like, whoa, like I count way out of the pace. And the point isn't to get better at counting or anything. The point is to think about nothing else, right? And then once you've allowed yourself to just kind of have a clear state of mind, then you think about the other things that actually matter. What that allows me to do is to organize my thoughts. So at competitions, there's so many things I'm thinking about: winning, how I'm feeling, my warm up, the climb in front of me, the climb I just did, how bad my performance just was on the last one. So allowing myself to just look at the clock allows me to organize the thoughts and prioritize which ones are important to me or not. So that's a little bit of, an actual practice. But
damn, Tim, I feel like that's like the pro tip I should bring in. Like I'm old and I'm into all the like biohacking stuff and like meditating, but that was so freaking good, man. I feel like meditation has kind of had its moments here and there, especially in like the Silicon Valley scene where it's like, oh, like all the best people meditate, but let's just break it down exactly what you're saying and why it can be so powerful. It's, what meditating is at its core is kind of two things. I'll say it's about learning how to focus on one thing, your breath, right? Like, and people say, oh, meditating is about just making your mind go empty. And it's like, you don't really do that. You focus on one thing. And I've used the Headspace app before as well, Tim. And so this is what is going to be behind executing. And Carlo talked about this too. It's focusing. And what was the name of that highball thing you did a movie with Black Diamond? What was
Focus,
that again?
Yes, sir.
Focus, right? It's what you don't want to be doing when you're climbing way off the deck is thinking about your laundry, and to think that it's just happenstance that you can focus your attention is a mistake. It's a practice, and the other thing I think is important about pointing out meditation is the recognition that thoughts just kind of come into your head. And, we just talked about excuses and things like this. And you can't always, you may not be able to control having those thoughts come into your head, but you can control how much effort you put towards, paying attention to them. So yeah, I remember in Headspace, they talked about like sitting there and just, your thoughts are like clouds that come into your brain. Then you just kind of can like watch them go by. And I would say the better you get at recognizing that thoughts appear is the quicker you can just say, okay, goodbye. You know, like, you know, so dude, I just,
man, powerful. What you just said was actually the key to performance under pressure, right? The pressure is just kind of the random thoughts that come in. Sometimes pressure is there that matters, and sometimes pressure doesn't matter, right? Sometimes pressure is relevant to your success, and sometimes it isn't, right? But it's not so much to navigate those things, you know, and get really good at navigating those things. It's when those things do appear inevitably, because they will, right? You and I can talk about performance under pressure right now with sitting down, but you know, and talk about when those things happen and what we're supposed to do. But it's more about when those things happen, what is your response and reaction type of mechanics? How's your process in terms of your response and reactions? And yeah, meditation is much more when those things actually happen, how do you respond, right? How are you able to navigate those thoughts?
Tim, this is my favorite thing about us doing this podcast and you being, you know, an amazing coach and us giving advice is we're always like, okay, you guys, like, these are some tools and tips, but you're on your own out there. Like, you know, it's always right. Like, okay, exactly. Like here's, you know, we're going to talk about performance under pressure, but when you're off the deck and you're by yourself, me and Tim are having a beer, like, you know, 200 miles away, you know? And it's like, but I think this is what's really important about what we're doing is demystifying, like, you know, going and having a test piece coach help you is not like some silver bullet that's just like, now you're good. It's like, it's still on you. Like you are still the climber, yeah, at the exactly. End of the day. And that's what I love about climbing. And it's, and so, yeah, performance under pressure, meditation. Damn, Tim, that was good.
Do you have a pro tip?
I do, but it just sucks compared to that. It has nothing to do with performance under pressure. Okay. Yeah. I'll follow that up, dude. So I've been climbing on the moon board again. I'm not as injured as I was. Although now it's getting to be a million degrees. So I was climbing on the moon board with a friend of mine. And this is maybe a little bit, maybe it's not pro tip. This is a intermediate to advanced tip. And I'm climbing with a buddy of mine who's better on the vertical terrain, and the moon board is not vertical terrain. And you know, his technique is pretty good on vert, but his fingers are a bit weak and his technique when it gets steep just is not so good. And we were doing a cross through or a crossover. Like you have a side pull with your left hand. And then he was going into a side pull with his right hand, just kind of right over the left hand. And so, you know, it was kind of like a drop knee to then reach through and a twist out. And at first he thought that his fingers were too weak, but showing him that line of pull on that side pull, and how he needed to get his hips close to the wall, really just solved the problem instantly for him. But the pro tip there is that when you climb on steeper terrain, you really need to be active in your lower body. It is not standing up on your feet and, you know, doing high steps like on vertical or slab terrain. It is really aggressively pulling your hips and body into the wall. So all of a sudden that side pull that seemed like shit because you're on 40 degrees becomes good because you're pulling on it straight down. And I wish I had videoed it because you could just see how loose and floppy his lower body was when he was struggling. And then when he really embraced that body tension, that squeezing with the feet and pulling in, he just crushed the move every time. And it's just a good reminder, your lower body needs to be high tension, really active. And I think everyone out there who's climbing double digits is going to be like, oh yeah, of course. But it's a fundamental that you don't want to sleep on. Like it is crucial.
I love this pro tip. And actually the key word there, fundamental. So you're saying maybe it's a intermediate to advanced thing. And you're also saying that maybe these double digit climbers will be like, oh yeah, whatever. No, I have coached a lot of double digit climbers who don't possess this fundamental. Sometimes it happens. Sometimes you get on the wall and they respond and then react to, oh, I feel like I can't do this move if I don't happen to activate my body. Dude, that should be a fundamental. If you are climbing on an overhang, already anticipate that stuff. Sequence it, anticipate when your body and how you're going to activate your lower body and how you're going to keep it. Because I have never climbed anything overhung where my lower body isn't active. And if I do a movement where my lower body's active, I actually do have to think about it so that it fires consistently and I can control that. So amazing pro tip. I think people should always think about that and anticipate it before you get onto the wall. And to assume that strong climbers already possess this. No, I think climbers happen to succeed, but maybe don't understand how to control it.
It's actually something that I've struggled with helping friends who are maybe V9, V10, and they're climbing with kind of like a notch up climbers, and it's something that's really hard to teach is that tight body tension, that keeping those feet on when it gets steep, and really recognizing the amount of aggressive effort you need to put into your lower body, because it's not about cutting your feet, jumping to some hold. Like that only works to a certain extent, and you do not get to jump on a roof to like a V13 crimp and have your feet cut. Like I don't care how strong you are, that's not what's going on. It's about extreme strength of the lower body. So yeah, it's a hard one to teach, but
I'll double that. It's super hard to teach. That's like the big concept I've tried to teach for a long time is mechanics.
But step one is recognize hearing this, and then when you do that move, like my buddy was like, oh, that's like hard, or there's a lot of tension. In fact, it seemed like he felt like it was more tiring, like it was too hard to do it that way because he wasn't used to it. But that's a hint, like, oh, you're
totally,
your leg felt tired, your butt felt tired from that move. It's like, there's a key, like you're spreading the effort around instead of just canvassing.
Totally. Okay. Let's get into it. Okay. So you are about to pull onto your project. You just gave it, an hour's worth of sessioning, and you figured out all the moves. And then you figured out that the secret to sticking the crux halfway up is to think about your lower body, exactly what Josh is talking about. And you need to perform. And then Tim walks in through the door and says, I'll give you $100 right now if you stand on this try. How do you feel? What are you thinking about? That's the pressure, right? How do you get it done? What do you think about, right? And of course you pull on, you're like, fuck, I gotta do this. Oh, but what if I slip here? And I gotta, oh man, but I'm for sure gonna stop on this, crux move and not think about the right thing. It's like, you already see the failure in your process for, kind of solving these things. So we talked about meditation and kind of allowing those thoughts to come in and navigate them, think about them, right? I think a key thing that I have with a lot of youth clients and a lot of like younger people that I talk to and coach, and the first thing that, so youth regionals just happened. I just, talked to a couple of my youth clients, and it's actually why I brought up performance under pressure, because I was just talking about them with my youth clients. And, the first things that we talk about is, how did regionals go, and, why could have gone better, or why couldn't, why did it go bad, or like whatever it is. And a lot of the time I hear my youth clients talk about the thing they were thinking about, the thing that they were thinking about other than the exact part of performance. There's no secret here. If you want to perform and focus in the moment, there's one thing you're trying to accomplish. It's your output of mechanics. It's your sequencing, then realizing what you're trying to do in climbing, and then your output of mechanics. If you focus in the moment, you have to grab this hold, step on this foot, and create a lot of tension. Going back to the beginning of our podcast, it is already hard to perform, period. Period. It's already hard to have the mental strength, to already have the technical ability, to already have the physical strength to perform at a high level in climbing. It's already hard to do that. So focus on that, right? If other things come into play, digest them, let them come in, figure out what's important and what's not important, and then focus in the moment. I think that's the step that a lot of my youth clients struggle, every youth climber I've ever talked to, in fact, struggles with this. When things come in, they start to react to it and then focus on that. Okay, the $100, you start to think about the $100, you start reacting based off that. You start to survive. You start to defend versus be aggressive and offensive. So we start, especially in sport climbing, this happens super often. I think, in fact, in my opinion, it's why a lot of American youth climbers suck at sport climbing. You go to any other country and there's a lot of sport climbing available because they're just used to the pressure. But you put a lot of, youth American sport climbers on ropes for the first time. And 80-90% of the climbing curriculum that youth team kids do nowadays is on boulders. It's not on sport routes, right? So when you hop on a sport route for the first time and you're like, oh, you got on site, right? Which is what sport climbing competitions are. It's on site, not so much the culture of like trying and then, trying to execute. Of course you don't want to fall, but is that the goal of sport climbing, to not fall? No, the goal of sport climbing is to get to the top. There's already kind of an example there of focusing on the pressure of not falling versus the goal, the focus of how do I get to the top, right? There's an offensive mentality here and a defensive mentality here. And it's important to focus on the offensive mentality.
Dude, I just clicked Mark Clip because that was so good there. Offensive versus defensive. This language, like when you first said the goal isn't the goal like not to fall but that's like the wrong language. Even though it achieves the same thing, it's coming from this negative standpoint. Like, totally. God, I remember doing rope comps and being so terrified of the first bolt, like, and just being like, oh, I gotta make it through.
Totally. How do you not fall? You perform better.
Yeah.
Not falling.
Tim, if you came through the door, I would just ask you to sign my bicep, because that's enough pressure, is just having Tim Kang watching me climb. So what's really interesting is this idea of focus is one of the things that makes sport climbing so fun for me and so difficult in a way, is that when you tie in, you start up that wall, I'm thinking more outdoor climbing, which is still applicable. You get to that rest, and you look up and you're like, okay, I'm at like bolt two. I just got to make it to that next rest. But your mind starts kind of wandering at that rest. You're like, oh, dude, I'm kind of pumped. Like, I don't know. Like, I'm just not feeling it. It feels kind of hot. Like, I don't know. Like, and that self-talk is the opposite of what works, because you need to be in that moment. You're trying to, lower your heart rate, relax, think about the sequence, right? Just what you're talking about. Focus on the climbing. It's hard enough as it is. And I think it's one of the things that is a lost art, hearing about how they've had more kids train on bouldering, because physically it may be just as good to prepare them for a rope climb, but there is a mental side of it that's lost.
Yeah. I love what you're talking about, like the when those external factors kind of trickle in, and specifically in outdoor climbing, this happens like far more often because routes are longer and there are a lot more external factors, like the heat and your skin hurts and it's hard to read the route and the greasy, the rock, the foot's greasy and like that moves a little too far and all these things, right? Oh, the draw's too far beneath me, or my belayer sucks, or like whatever it is. Literally whatever it is, say it to yourself. Say it out loud. Say it inside. Say it. Just say it. Say it. But, right? So, oh, it's hot. Okay, but I'm going to do this. What's the so what? What are you going to do? What are you going to focus on? And always pick an actionable thing. Try to acknowledge the things that you can control versus the things that you cannot control, right? Because it's hot, but I'm going to, take my shirt off. It's like, okay, fine. I guess you could do that. And I guess that's maybe for some people works, but it doesn't actually solve very much. Maybe it makes you slightly more confident in the moment, but does it actually solve anything? No, maybe it's not going to be solved, right? Maybe, okay, so it's hot, but I have climbed in hotter before. Okay, it's hot, but I have definitely done sequences sweaty. Okay, it's hot, but if I get to that jug as quickly as I can, I'll be fine. Like getting yourself something to be like, okay, this sucks, but I can do this, right? And I think that's a step that a lot of people forget, or maybe take too long to get to, where the practice that I have in sport climbing is find the thing that's going to piss me off, find the thing that's going to frustrate me or make me struggle, and then find the butt as fast as I can, right? It's like, okay, well, and I sequence that actually. I take a lot of time to sequence and visualize and anticipate the struggle, then I answer with a butt. And it's like, well, that move's going to be super hard to commit to this foot because this foot's really far this way. And when I start going for this move, it's going to pivot and slide and I'm going to swing this way. But I'm going to do this to make sure that this happens. And that for me adds the focus component in the moment where I can actually pick and choose what to focus on versus react. We don't want to react and respond. We want to pick and choose and focus. Again, offense versus defense.
Dude, that's in my notes here. I literally wrote, I'm going to take a page out of Tim's book, focus on what you can control, not what you can't.
Nice. Josh Levin actually taught me that one, by the way. Dude, got a shout out.
Damn good competitor. Really knows how to bring what he has at that moment. That's interesting because I have like, don't worry about temps. Don't worry about skin. Don't have excuses. But I like your butt.
Thanks,
should I explain
man.
That better? Yeah. This is just a podcast, audio only. We're all wearing clothes. That is the solution. You're taking it from, you're acknowledging that negative thoughts arise and you're tackling them. And I think I'm going to connect that to kind of one of my big points or how I've handled this stuff is when it comes to performing under pressure, just recognizing that you are performing under pressure and not shying away from it. Like I'm not a fan of this, like tricking yourself into it, not being a big deal. Like, oh, it's not actually $100. I don't really care or whatever. It's not a big deal in this comp. It's like, no, it is. Like sometimes especially when we're kind of newer in these situations, maybe we're feeling pressure for the wrong reason. That's actually kind of fake pressure. And, you know, I would say you'll get over that as time goes on, just through exposure. We're talking more about like really things that are a big deal. And I kind of want to dispel this myth. I feel like there's this talk, you see it in videos from pros often where, you know, they've been trying a route for 2 months and they're not sending. And then they kind of like let go or give up almost. And they like stop caring. And then they finally send. And the reason why I think it's a myth is because that doesn't mean that the average Joe, AKA me, the average Josh, should go and just not care, right? Like I you don't show up and just not care. What I hear from that is that they cared a lot every single try, and it became such a big part of what they were doing. And it's kind of adjusting the amount of mental tactics that they're going through throughout those, you know, multiple month things. So they're not showing up and not focusing. They're focused. It's just they're understanding that mental battle. They are struggling. And when they show up and do it that time, it's not because they stopped caring. It's that they were able to tap into that focus and, you know, overcome whatever barriers they were, physical, mental. And I think that's an important thing to point out, that do not shy away from the pressure. You can't just swallow it and bury it. Maybe you can once or twice, but that's not a long-term strategy. And don't get fooled into hearing pros say that, like, oh, it's just when I didn't care. Like, because that's not what really happens. In general, when it comes to pressure, you don't really rise to the moment. You usually sink to the level of your training. And that's like a Marine thing. I think that's like an Army thing where they're, you know, because it's like when there's bullets flying around, you don't like all of a sudden become a hero and do the right thing. It's like, no, you're scared shitless. Just like that happens when you're way off the deck. And what happens is actually you kind of go into autopilot. And that's what me and Tim are here to point out is, let's practice this. Let's acknowledge what's going on and figure out how to train it so that when that time comes, instead of hoping that you become superhuman, just recognizing that you've been there and you do your best.
Yeah, man, let's hover on this thing that you just said about caring. I think, you know, and it is dispelling a myth that, you know, the caring more or whatever, everyone cares. I think it's not a surprise that pressure, all these things that I wrote about pressure, desire, stress, expectations, societal, financial, time, effort, and skin are all only coming if you care. Those other things only come if you do care. They come a lot more if you care a lot more too. It's actually the biggest conversation I have with all of my youth clients that I've had since I was 17, with, you know, any person I try to mentor or try to teach or try to like at least just sit there and meditate and like reflect on certain things is like, hey, like, why do you care? You know, like talking about why they care, assuming that they care and why they do it, right? And of course, we don't even have to talk about why they care because they're kids and like, of course they care, right? And then we talk about what do you care about, right? I think that's the difference between professionals is like, okay, they obviously care. They actually care a lot more, what you're saying, probably care a lot more than you do, right? And then with that care comes a lot of positive and negative things. And it's just about dissecting it, navigating it and going, and I don't want to go too deep into that. But that's a huge factor here is you have to care. You have to care to get you induced to do certain things, to apply at a very high level. When you care, pressure is going to come and we have to kind of navigate those things as they come. You kind of mentioned something about that Marine concept, this autopilot, dropping down to the level that you are actually able to perform and you perform autopilot. I actually spent, when I was 17, going to high school, my senior year, I was allowed to take a class called ASI, Advanced Science Investigation. And it was the only class that I was actually excited to take in high school because it probably was not like a high school level class. And this class is amazing. You had to apply for it. Only one single class was allowed. So it was about like 25 students were allowed to take this class. I applied and somehow got into the class. And I think it was because the thing I was trying to study was really cool. It was performance under stress. It was focus with stress. That was the title of my investigation, and I never got to finish it because I dropped out of high school the second semester of my senior year. But when I started studying,
you got a PhD in focus under stress. I saw the video.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, I left high school to go follow my PhD. It was a movie. You guys could go check it out on YouTube. So what I was studying was focus under stress, and I was playing basketball a lot during that time. I was playing basketball pretty much my whole life until climbing. And I was still playing basketball at that time. And a hard thing I had to deal with was I was a shooting guard and I was shooting a lot. And I would choke like crazy. I was actually a solid shot. I could play a lot. Like most of what we were playing was shooting games, like just a lot of like around the world horse, like a lot of that type of stuff. So, and I was being, being short when I was a freshman in high school, I was 4'11 and like 70 pounds. So I was really, really small. They call me Tiny Tim throughout my entire middle school, like basketball time. My entire team called me Tiny Tim. And so I was like, all right, I was playing basketball. I loved it. I was working really hard and I would get to high school and everyone would be bigger than me. And I was really scared. I would miss all of my shots and I'd be like, dude, what is going on? So I was like, all right, I'm going to study this thing. And then climbing, I got into climbing and I was doing a lot of competitions and I would choke, like, you know, falling on, I was climbing like V8, falling on V4 in competitions. Like, what is going on? Like fumbling all my stuff. I was like, all right, I'm going to look into stress. And what I found was a study that was talking about baseball and, you know, how they would practice like batting and pitching. And essentially they would practice the same thing over and over and over again and add stress slowly and start to add stress factors like cameras, loud noises, like, you know, just kind of shocking things, financial stresses, of course, and implementing stress slowly so that you perform the same thing over and over again. It wasn't this new concept of reacting better. It was trying to repeat the thing that you do intuitively really, really well. So what I got from that was both sides, performing with pressure and performing without pressure. So that's what climbing is. Because climbing isn't this intuitive thing that you can do over and over again. It's not a baseball swing. It's not, right? It is understanding in a new moment what the best thing to do is and then performing that. So what does that take? A ton of development, a ton of projecting, a ton of like solving new things. But then also on this other side, doing this thing that you know perfectly. Any climber who climbs, you know, V4 can probably shit on a lot of V1s, right? Any climber who climbs V6 can probably shit on a lot of V2s and V3s. Any climber who climbs V10 can probably shit on V5s and V6s. Why? What about those things? What about the technique or the sequencing or the difficulty, the movements have you mastered? Lean into that. See the intuitive side of climbing, practice those things. And that's what I do. I jump back and forth. I shit on whatever climbs I can shit on, but then I also develop my, you know, my climbing on the other end. But when I'm doing those easy things, I add pressure. I say, let's do one try, right? Okay, I know I can do this thing, but let's add pressure. I'm going to do one try. Okay, let's make a bet with my friends. Okay, let's just pretend that I'm on my trip or I'm in the Olympics and this is my last try for the win, for the gold medal, right? I add pressure and I try to perform in those moments.
So I just want to point out that you kind of have to put yourself into these situations. That's kind of what you're saying. You won't know how you react exactly until you're in the moment. And so the better you can mimic that in your training, the better you'll perform. And I like that example of baseball where it's like, okay, now let's put on bright lights on you. Now let's put on cameras. Now let's put like, you know, 10 people in the stands, about 100 people, and be nice to be able to do that very step function wise, because it's sometimes hard to make that big leap. But that's kind of what we're going to get into in this next section, is really being pragmatic and practical about, so, okay, yeah, so you agree with us, great. Like, what do I do? You know, like, what do I do? And you alluded to some techniques there, and I guess I just want to go into a little bit deeper with these drills. And I actually wanted to share one that I did before going to Nationals that you just reminded me, where I went to Planet Granite, Sunnyvale, and basically picked out like four climbs and then did like 4 or 5 minute rounds. And it was like, okay, like you have 4 minutes to do this. And just, it's not the perfect example of what I was going to encounter in Nationals, but at least I had this one added thing that instead of just being like, I'm going to climb these 4 V10s today, it was like, okay, no, I'm going to set up a clock. I'm going to take it seriously. I'm going to have 4 minutes on, 4 minutes off, and I'm mimicking that. And so then when I show up at Nationals, I have one less thing that is completely unfamiliar to me. And so, yeah, Tim, do you want to share some of the drills that you do with clients?
Yeah, for sure. I think, a really key thing to get here is you don't have to compete at Nationals to do drills at the climbing gym. I'll just say that. I think I'm going to debunk this crazy, stupid myth that I see in the gyms nowadays, is where people avoid training drills. People avoid like these crazy, you know, comp team things to do at the gym because, you know, I don't go do the 4 minute on-site rounds. Like, well, But I'm sure you have gone on a trip where, you know, your friends want to leave and you have one try left and you better send in that moment. Like, I'm sure you show up to a boulder and you're time limited because your friends want to go somewhere else. Like, there's always a scenario where there's pressure on a trip outside. And if you aren't that person, you're probably not listening to this podcast. And if you are listening to this podcast and you still aren't that type of person, wake up. It's a sick way to perform. It's like, it's way more like, don't you want to care?
I hope that there's not listeners that found their way and are like, man, why would you even like want to do a boulder first try? Or like,
hopefully not. And hopefully don't lean into that side of the culture, because you know, if you're here, you want to send, and if you're here, you want to get better. And if you're here, you want to perform under pressure.
Dude, I actually remember being a kid, and I won't name names, but there's definitely these two groups, and they both, all of them went on to become incredible climbers. And there was one group that was very competition oriented. There was another group that kind of, you know, said competition wasn't cool and they were more focused on the outdoors. And, you know, it was a mistake on both their sides to kind of denigrate the other, because they really do go hand in hand. And so if you find yourself talking shit about some discipline, you're probably just, you're not realizing it, but you're showcasing some weakness or fear that you have, and you should tackle it.
Yeah, agreed. I love that. Well, okay. So here are some, drills that I've done with some of my youth clients. I don't think these apply to everybody, but just here's an idea for like some drills you could do. So with one of my buddies, Will, he's been doing a lot of spray wall climbing. He doesn't have access to great, sport climbing, but he's in sport climbing season and struggles with kind of his like, he struggles with the one go, sport rip mentality where, you know, he doesn't really necessarily do his best and, you know, over defends and like over, you know, does those things. And so a lot of the drills that he's been doing is he creates himself like a 15 to 20 move circuit. That's really hard. Like the perfect circuit here would be falling on the last move of each one. And it'll, for him, he'll do, a couple of circuits where it'll be rainbow feet. So he's just getting used to just the intensity of it. And then some drills he'll do where he picks all the feet. And if he falls, he'll pick one adjustment for a foot. And that for him allows him to choose the decisions that he's making rather than just adding pressure. Of course, that adds pressure, right? You have one try, but then you have to correct the thing that you're going to control for your next try. So for him, that's something that's really specific. I don't think a lot of people enjoy this type of drill, so maybe not something applicable for everybody. But a drill that could apply is something that I've also mentioned to some of my clients is if there's a new set at your gym, go and look at the new set. Find the grade for you that is about your flash grade. And I think most people's flash grade should consist of like a 70% send. So, you know, most of the time you're sending, but it's okay if you obviously don't send it on some of your flash tries. But look for your 70% grade, go down a grade and go up a grade. So let's say your flash grade's V6, do, you know, find a V5 and find a V7. You could find all of the sixes and sevens. Give them all up to three tries. We'll just say, you know, just go into the new set. It's also, first of all, it's a good way of sampling all of the climbs. And second of all, it's also just a good way of reserving your energy versus like getting trapped in, you know, cycling. Let's say your flash grade is V6 and then you try this V5 and you happen to get stuck on it for like 15 tries because you happen to foot slip every time and then you didn't do the right beta and somebody showed you the right beta. It's like, it allows you to focus on your tries and be a little bit more structured in like how you're, getting the information for the climbs. Allow yourself three tries. If you happen to get halfway or more on your first try, give yourself one try more instead. So two tries instead of three tries. But for me, this is a constant practice. If I go to a new set, I don't even have a set up structured way of going to the new set, but this is a constant thing I do with new sets that I go to the gym for. I just go to the new set. I look at the climbs that are really good testers for me. If the climbs are like good for me to do, and you know, yeah. So what are the climbs that are good for you? Maybe not the straightforward ones. Maybe not the ones that you are really confident in committing to the sequences where, you know, the crimp ladder, maybe don't do the crimp ladder unless the crimp ladder is exactly the one that's super hard for you. But why are the climbs hard for you, right? Take the time to sequence the climbs versus just looking at the grades. Sequence the climbs and see what are the factors that are hard for me and pick a climb that is really easy for you on the harder grade, right? If your flash grade's the V6 and the 7's the harder grade for you, maybe that's the one that is the simpler one for you, the one that you can read better. And the 5 is the one that is more, you know, if you don't like dinos, find the dino of the set. There's probably going to be one, you know, find the one that has a slot move or the really hard rockover move or the really hard like flip dino or whatever it is. Like, you know, find specific characteristics of those climbs and then try to rotate that set to set. That's something that's a practice that I do constantly.
And I love that drill. And I would encourage people to take it up a notch by doing it with a friend and making like friendly wagers, or, you know, it's like whoever flashes the most of these, you know, seven climbs has to buy dinner tonight. Or
nice.
Something.
Love
like,
it.
You know, just anything to just up it a little bit. And you just reminded me that I used to do that. When we have a new set at Planet Granite, which was, you know, when I really climbed the gym a lot, I would try to flash every single thing on the newest set. And that was my thing. And I took it seriously.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's the thing is sometimes it's easy to lull yourself into just kind of playing around and saying it doesn't matter. And so, you know, this is what training is, though, is finding those opportunities to kick it up a notch, to make it more serious. And it's actually something that I did for the barn board, that barn board thing I did with when I was trying to do all of the 2019 moon board set. So I'm in my freaking barn out in the middle of nowhere by myself. And, you know, so it's like, let's say you're on a V-set, or let's say you're on something that's easier for you, but maybe not super easy. And, you know, you're trying to flash it and, you know, you go to match the finish hole and your foot kind of picks and maybe you almost match the hold at the end of the finish hold, but like, you know, you just kind of hopped off. You didn't really take it seriously. And for me, videoing myself and then posting it and climbing those benchmark or rankings on the moon board account, like that's what made it serious for me. So, you know, try to figure out little tricks to up the stakes, whatever it may be, you know, telling someone, like even just telling your buddy, like, oh, I'm totally going to flash this. Like, I'm totally going to send this in less than three tries. And if you don't, you look like a doof. So, you know, just anything you can do to, you know, make it more serious is what training is about. It's about training. You know, it's
totally, it's about, that your barn board account, reminded me of probably the most important part of this, more practical approach to your guys' sessions, you know, going to the new set and picking certain things, make a game out of it with your friends. If you happen to be by yourself, that's okay. The reflection period afterward. Once you're done, take the time to go back, journal it, talk about it with your friends. I want to also kind of demystify the word excuses here. I think it's really easy for us to like not share the objective things that we've run into, the certain factors, the external factors that caused pressure for us. And sometimes we avoid that because we're too quick to call them excuses, right? Like, oh, well, I wasn't able to commit for this movement or hold my control into this wall because I was swinging out. That's a really good way of reflecting on certain, or because this felt like this hole felt really greasy. So I had to compensate and put a lot more pressure on this foot, but then it didn't allow me to focus on the hand while I was doing this move. So I couldn't keep it for a long time. Great. That could be easily seen as an excuse, right? That could easily be seen as an excuse, but acknowledge the difference between, you know, the reason why you're not deciding to do something versus the reason you weren't able to do something, right? The reason you're not able to, you know, the reason why you're not deciding to commit for something, that's the excuse, right? If you're like, I'm like tired today. It's like, fine. That's also something objective, but if you're leaning into it more because of the excuse factor versus the reason why you weren't able to fire something else, then that's maybe the excuse. But everything else, if you're missing out on talking about everything else, you're not aware of what to fix next time. You're not aware of what to pay attention to next time. So that reflection period for me is the biggest key thing. And so actually something that Josh, you know, you did on the barn board thing a lot was you often would, you know, actually you flashed a lot of the climbs that you did during that time, but you spent the time reflecting on your, you know, and a lot of it was just like really clean, objective analysis of like what you noticed on like what was important to focus on. But if you happen to fall on a climb, that's where you really dug in and you were like, well, but this is the reason why I fell, or like, this is what I was focusing on. This is what I should focus on. That reflection period afterward, I think is super, super important. Just share with your friends, share with a journal, just talk about it and deconstruct it yourselves.
Yeah. If you don't examine what's going on, then how do you expect to get better? Yeah, that's yeah, just a big thing of what exactly we're doing here. Well, here's some of my more practical, pragmatic approaches is what, you know, how does pressure typically materialize? It's kind of a faster heart rate, right? Like, I mean, often, you know, it's that moment before you pull on or before you tie in or while you're waiting in ISO and like your heart's beating, you know, just like you're like, damn, like I feel, you know, it's like that fight or flight. You're like, I am amped up. And we know just straight up scientifically, the higher your heart rate is, the less fine motor control you have. You know, your blood starts pooling in the bigger muscles in your body. You know, you lose focus, you lose control, you lose everything about what we need to do to be beautiful, technical, relaxed climbers that are just right at the edge of trying hard, but not too hard, and, you know, flowing, right? So you can't really control your heart rate directly. I can't just be like, heart, you're beating 170, please beat 120 or whatever, but you can control your breath. And, you know, Tim, you talk a lot about breath work. I don't like your breathing mechanics all on the wall are like another level above what I'm talking about here, but I'm going to talk about just the technique of when you're off the wall, before you start climbing, you can do things like box breaths, which are 4 seconds in, 4 second pause, 4 seconds out, 4 second pause. And that really has been shown to lower heart rate. And in general, you can just breathe out your exhales. If your exhales are longer than your inhales, that lowers your heart rate as well. And I love having this, you know, little tool in my toolbox that no one even knows about. Just take like, you know, take a breath. You're like, you know, people say it like, take a breath, chill out. When, you know, you see all the time when people are on the wall, maybe they get past the crux and you just like chill. But you can, you know, that is a good first line of defense. When you start feeling like you're just over revved and you're just stressing out. I do this a lot when I'm on a rest in on a sport climb is I'm just, you know, freaking maxing, freaked out, feel like I can't depump. I hate those moments where you're like trying to shake out and you're like, I think by shaking out, I'm actually getting more pumped. And you're like, let's just chill for a moment. Just give yourself a moment to see if that's what's really going. So that's one of my biggest really practical, like first line of defense tips. It's not exactly about performing under pressure in the sense of like, this is in this moment. It's more just, can you tamp down that excitement just a notch, just enough to sometimes that lets you kind of then put these other, you know, mental tricks and tips and focus into play. Cause sometimes you're just so revved up that you feel like you can't even focus, but breathing totally is something I think we always can kind of, you know, stop for a moment.
Love it. No, I can't echo that enough. I think, yeah, obviously if you watch me climb or listen to something or there's something out there about, you know, breath work for me. And I try to take it to the extreme because, you know, my key thing with breath work is that you can use your breath work. Keyword there, use, and not just having an awareness of breath work is great. You know, I think what Josh is talking about, you know, I think the key concepts of breath work are to control your heart rate, or at least to try to control your heart rate a little bit more, or get it to a neutral place, or sometimes to increase the heart rate. Sometimes it's really good for like being in a state of arousal. It's really important for high level performance as well throughout, you know.
That's short exhales, long inhales.
Right.
That's how you can do it.
Mm-hmm. And the Humerman podcast also has a really good breathwork podcast that talks about the different, you know, types of, you know, states you want to be in. So we won't go into that. You guys should listen to it. It is really good. It's taught me a lot about, you know, breathwork. But, you know, the key thing here is, yeah, okay, the breathwork awareness is super important. But using it, you can use it. You can use it in so many different ways. I won't go into that. I really have wanted to make a video on breathwork anyway. It's more visual than it is anything. It's a lot of practices that are very long-term practices. But the key thing here that I'm trying to say is you can use your breathwork, right? That's the only thing. And the reason why I keep repeating that is because the note that I have in terms of practical things is finding a reliance, finding some sort of reliance when shit hits the fan inevitably in climbing or throughout any performance. You want to find a simple reliance that actually does control the things that you're doing and actually helps you acknowledge the volatility of certain things, digest the income of certain things, the outcome of certain things, and then you can then make better decisions. And breathwork is a really good reliance to have. Even if you don't use your breath work, just having that kind of place to rely on is really important. A lot of people rely on other things. The biggest thing that I fix for climbers, the biggest leak that I see for climbers a lot of time is their reliances, actually, right? And the common reliance that we see is upper body over gripping, right? That is the first reliance that we see. If you feel bad on the climbing wall, if you feel like your foot's going to slip, if you feel like I can't do this move, if you feel like whatever, I don't care what it is, but I cannot tell you how many times I've heard, this felt like this, so I did this, right? And a lot of people don't even realize the reliance or the response that happens in their bodies, but fix those things. right? I'm not even telling you how to fix them. Josh has told you one, but fix those things. For you, you can always have a different reliance, right? But the reliance is really important to fix, because for me, a lot of my reliances have become footwork decisions, have become gripping less decisions, have become body positioning decisions, right? Like a lot of time in sport climbing, what I look for is really tight perch positions where my foot gets closer to my hips. Why? It just takes a lot of weight off my hands, right? It allows me to like kind of sit in a position where my tension is more in my feet and my hips rather than my hands, so I can look around so I don't have to like be gripped, right? If I grab a hold and a lot of people will like full crimp a hold that they don't like right away. Well, maybe don't do that, because you can't hold a hold in a full crimp for as long as you can in an open hand, only full crimp when you actually need it, right? Sometimes people are, when they're tired, believe they can't full crimp to create the most generation for a specific movement or to create the most tension. So get into the habit of throwing the full crimp in when you actually need it, right? So specific reliances can help.
So you said something there around people tend to end up relying on upper body dominance when they get, you know, when they feel like they're under pressure or when they get, you know, and when they get pumped and stuff too. I was just thinking about being on this trad climb with actually the same dude I was talking about the lower body tension in my pro tip. And he got above some gear and he got scared and his feet just started skating. Just, you know, just skating, man. And this is actually someone who's really good with footwork and likes to put a lot of weight on his feet. And I guess pressure is just another thing that breaks in you. It's like being tired causes you to break down on form. You know, there's all sorts of things that cause you to break down, right? And I guess where I'm going with that is that I think it would be good if you can recognize what happens when you're under stress. And we're talking about mental pressure typically right here, but again, this may show up when you're tired, you know, pumped, whatever the case may be. Recognize what starts breaking down. And again, typically me and Tim are going to say probably with 90% of people, it's less weight on the feet, tunnel vision, inability to, you know, see feet kind of outside. Yeah. It's so common how people like won't see feet that aren't just within their own little tiny bubble. So recognize how you break down uniquely, and then have that in your awareness so that when you start feeling yourself struggle, go like, okay, I need to really put weight on my feet. Like, oh, you think you're putting weight on your feet, but I know that I'm freaked out. I'm way over my bolt. And what I tend to do is, you know, just pull on my upper body. I'm not weighing my feet enough. So when you have been in these positions of stress and you've seen how you failed, now you know. Like, and keep that. That's going to be a trick for you. Like, know where you fail and then double down on that type of, you know, emphasis on those areas or moves or feet that you would, you know, you're going to be using poorly.
Foot slips and dry fires very rarely surprise me nowadays when I see them in my clients. Nowadays, when I see those things happen, I'm like, well, obviously you slipped because your tension rose, right? Height, it rose to your upper body. And where does that take away from? It takes away from your lower body. It's not a surprise that pro climbers just slip less often than you do. I remember the first realization I had of that was like at a couple of national competitions, or, you know, pretty much any competition. Actually, I would compete against Nathaniel Coleman. I realized that I would slip a lot on like specific positions or like specific moves, literally the same exact move I would do. And Nathaniel would go up and like never slip on it. I'd be like, what's going on? Like, how is he not slipping? And it's like, he just looks calmer. And, you know, you just start to pay attention to the body tension that would change. And it wasn't changing for him. He's super relaxed. And like that allows him to perform. And it was super consistent. And, yeah, I lost my train of thought there. But
okay, well, that was money. Nathaniel Coleman is definitely knows how to perform in finals.
Oh, I had one more. Here's what I was thinking about. Yeah. I had one more like practical thing that you guys could do. It's probably the first concept that I start talking about with any of my clients in an actual climbing session, is the breath work that you can invite in climbing. The easiest breath work to have constantly is your exhale. And here's how you can use your exhale. The moment you feel effort, any sort of physical exertion, take an exhale, use it to find a specific part of your body that is tense and try to relax it with the breath. So the biggest point of tension that I see in climbers is their shoulders, is their traps, actually, the middle part of your shoulders. When you engage, 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 and your shoulders, your traps rise towards your neck, that generally doesn't relax. I think it's fine to have it come, because when you're like tightening up, you're like, okay, like I got to tense up to like move whatever. As soon as you get to a place where you like set your feet up, often you could take a breath and you'll see people move their feet into a place, take their breath, and they're still risen. Even if they take the breath, the tension is still there, right? So use the breath to release that tension, right? You can also be, I've shown this to a lot of my clients also will respond with, but I need that tension to stay on the wall. Change that language. Here's my advice for you. Change that definition. You don't need jack. You don't need that. What you need is to be tense in your hands and your feet and do the proper technique, but you don't need to be tense all there. You don't need to be tense in your lower back. You don't need to be tense in your thighs and your glutes. You don't need to be tense in you need to be tense in your hands and your feet. With those things, you should maintain a lot of high intensity tension, but relax elsewhere. Use that exhale to relax certain parts of your body. Your body is not one tight thing that is engaged all the time. It's tense in certain places, but relaxed in other places. So in your warmups, you know, whenever you find effort, the first moment of effort, invite the exhale, use the exhale to associate it to a very specific muscle and relax that muscle with the exhale. Then when things happen over time, you'll recognize stress, you'll recognize tension, and then start to find an exhale, hopefully.
Good stuff, man. I've got a couple more practical tips for really making it, just for making sure that you're at your best during those high pressure moments. And I already said, really embracing it. You know, like I think this is one of my big breakthroughs, is just recognizing that this is the time and you want to fucking make it work. Like, don't fool yourself and say like, oh, like, you know, this is just kind of like an 85% try, or, you know, cause you know, let's say you're on some trip outdoors, you never know when you're going to come back. Like, don't, you know, save it. You know, maybe you'll never even compete again, or maybe you'll move away. Maybe that boulder will fall over. Yeah, be okay with dropping into that moment and making it happen. But how do you really do that? I like having a ritual before I pull on. I think setting up, you know, acknowledging that it's time to focus, it's time to send, it's time to execute, and having a little ritual to make that happen is important. And I would say, I'm going to tell you my ritual. I would say the shorter the ritual, the better, because the faster you can just go from relaxed to turning it on not just turning it on, but dropping into that moment is better, right? You don't want to have to, you know, I used to be like, oh, I got to put my left shoe on first before my right shoe. Yeah. It's just like, you don't want to get sucked into that. But, you know, I brush every hold. I'm thinking bouldering usually, even if they've already been brushed. People go like, oh, I just brushed it for you. I'm like, thank you. I still have to brush the holds. I take off my shirt and I hit the holds with my shirt. And then I sit down and I kind of yell a few times, like, not, you know, I kind of grunt, or like, I kind of just am there. Right. And it's a little different when I'm on a rope and I'm coming out of a rest, but I usually do kind of like shake my head a little and give like a little grunt. But it's just something about, you know, we're just such creatures of habit and ritual. And if every time you do that, you then give it your all and focus your all, you can kind of trick yourself into just being like, this is the time to perform. Let's execute right now. And so that's one of my big things, is being okay with caring, with saying it's right now. Let's fucking make it work. Like, no excuses. Let's show up right now. And then following the ritual that I always do to make sure I'm there to, you know, to execute in that moment.
Yeah, that's amazing. I won't go too deep into, you know, my rituals and stuff. I have a lot that I don't think exactly, you know, but anyway, I think what I do want to echo there is, when you follow your rituals over and over again, it almost makes you perform. It almost makes you like into that dedicated, committed, you know, we all have like climbing sessions where we're just trying something and we're figuring something out. We're like, it just feels weird. I can't do that. And then you have this moment of realization where you're like, dude, like, I could just do this thing if I had just tried harder. Like, if I had just been like, I'm just going to be committed. Like, this try, I'm just going to go for it. You know, like, and for me, it is a lot of vocal things. Like, usually for a move, if I'm like, just this hold hurts, or that heart, it's too hard to like stick this thing, I'll usually just sot, you know, just like, like just go through it. And that induces me to just try whatever I'm trying to focus on better. And nowadays, you know, after a decade of just solely priming myself for that performance. Nowadays, if I don't perform, it's weird. And I'm like, okay, what am I missing from my little ritual? So I just want to echo, those things just happen and they compound over and over and over again. It makes it easier to perform. It makes it, you know, more natural. And then when you don't do those things that are, you're not focusing on the right things in that moment, you're almost like, what's missing? Like, what do I have to lean into and focus on now versus just the technical things or just the mental things or just the physical things? It's almost all of those things cohesively together. And though just doing it over and over again helps with that.
Oh, sorry, man. You kind of cut out for a moment. But I'm sure what you said was gold. Why it matters to do these rituals and to show up and ritual, you said that the more you do it, it just kind of becomes a thing. You just perform. And it makes me think of this idea that every time you do something, like you're casting a little vote of who you are. And, you know, it's like, you know, when you get above your draw and then you get scared and you say take and you jump off, and like somewhere inside of you, you're just like, fuck, dude, what the fuck? Like, is that me? Am I that kind of, am I the one who yells take? Like, you know, and it's just, I mean, Tim, you're cracking up, but like, that's the truth, right? And
I love it.
Well, it's just, you know, this is why sports is good for kids or whatever. It's like, I just remember being a kid and going and getting fucking scared. And back then, bolting was a little bit more wild. Like, go do heinous cling. That was my first 12A. It's up in
Smith.
In Smith. It's kind of wild, dude. I'm like 10 years old, right? And I remember being super scared and you know, pushing through it, not always pushing through it, right? Being scared, like being like, I want to do on top rope, you know, and my friends being like, no, or, you know, or fine, you know, and looking down on me. And it's just like, it's important to know that, you know, every time you do something, you make a little vote to yourself. Like, no one really cares. You know, they're like, sure, Josh, you want to top rope it? Fine. Go. I'll belay you. But like, I just, you know, a little part of me would be like, is that the kind of person I want to be? And so go into these situations, and make the hard choices, and it builds. Like that's kind of what made me think of it, Tim, as you're saying, eventually you just start making performance and showing up the best you can be, kind of who you are, because every time you do it, you make another little, you know, mark in that box of, this is the kind of person I am. When I focus and show up, I bring my all. And yeah, I would just say lean into that. That is a practical, pragmatic tip. But just to close out that section with one last little thing that is still along this line is, I really do like the visualization stuff. I've said this before. I didn't come up with this. It's like your body can't do what your mind doesn't see first. So, you know, take a moment, climb the move or the boulder in your head, see what, or, you know, feel what it is like to latch that move. And it really helps where if you, you know, get scared or you're stressed out, if in your head, you've at least spent some time feeling the move, doing it, you know, feeling what success is like, then you can lean into that feeling a little bit better. And I just think visualization is a underrated form of performance.
Totally. I want to go back in a little bit on what you said about vote for yourself. I love that concept of just, it's something that I maybe didn't discover until more recently, actually. And yeah, maybe this is you just rubbing off onto me. But man, like you can choose who you are. You can always choose who you are. And you can only choose who you are, though, by the decisions that you make, right? Not so much just by convincing yourself that suddenly you're a committed sport climber or whatever. It's when the things are hard and when the things are scary, you say, well, but this time I'm going to go for the next hold. Maybe the next time I'm going to stick it, you know, like slowly making the decisions that are hard, that are scary, that are difficult and uncomfortable, and then trying to make those decisions. You can always vote for yourself as a person. And the more often you vote for yourself, the more you are that person. And I love that what you said there.
Well, this is kind of some of the stuff that I think we talk about when it comes to more dangerous stuff or highballing is putting yourself into these situations. And that's where you really find out what you're made of, because
totally,
you know, this is what I love about long, scary sport climbs. I really love this in deep water soloing, is you get so tired and scared, and you're up there and all you can hear is the wind or the ocean, and you just are so by yourself, and you just are, you're laying bare to yourself. You just, this is you. And you hear yourself, you're like, oh, I'm so pumped. I literally talk to myself. I'm like, oh, I don't know if I'm going to make this. I'm like, come on, Josh, like you got this. But it's just, that's how you find, you know, that's not just how you find out who you are, but that's how you make yourself into something totally. More. I always like this book called The Obstacle is the Way. And it's this idea that you don't know, you have to literally put yourself into situations to find out.
Right.
You know, what you are. So I don't know, dude, we're getting meta, yeah. But it's why dude, I fucking love climbing.
I've said to clients multiple times, like you don't even get that vote ballot cast option many times in a day. Like you don't even get that opportunity that many times in a session. The better you are, the more often you get those opportunities. But for me, what's like 10 times a session where I'm like such in a rev moment on a difficult climb. And the climb has to be good enough to like actually challenge that of me, and has to be like the quality has to be the right spread and the difficulty has to be high enough to get me pumped to a place. And then I have to make this extremely volatile decision. And then, you know, I only get those like a couple of times a session, and I only get those sessions a couple of times a week. So like, how often can I even vote for myself? So make sure you line that up. How many trips do I get a year to go and try this highball thing? You know, like how often am I going to be in this position to vote for myself? So when you do, just make sure you cast the right vote, because often it's too easy to be like, nah, like not this time. Today's too tired. Today's not the day. Today I'm just like, you know, too sweaty for it. Like, or whatever it is, you know, like just try to make the right vote every time.
So good. When you make the right vote, you know, and you nothing but smiles when you come down.
Yeah,
even if you didn't do the move, but you're like, yeah, but I was there. So even though maybe we're going away from the practical and, you know, starting to wrap things up, I actually wanted to bring up this one moment in your climbing that we talked about on the Tim's Best Day Ever podcast, where we talked about your highball link up. And it just stuck in my head because it was so epic when you talked about it. And it was getting that pinch on Ambrosia way off the deck and it not being so good, being kind of greasy. And I guess I think we've already covered all of the techniques that maybe you put into place on that climb in this podcast, not just in that last one. But I guess just can you like reiterate some of those things, like where, you know, the hole didn't feel quite like you expected it, but you're off the deck. Like, you know, can we just kind of like revisit that and
yeah.
kind of relay it to what we're talking about here?
Yeah. So that came up because you asked, you know, was there any oh shit moments for the day? Right. And it's like, okay, you assume that if I'm going to try to go for five highballs, you know, I've worked the shit out of them and they're not going to feel hard or anything. No, that's the challenge, right? The challenge is that they're going to feel hard. They're going to feel insecure, period. No matter what day, what perfect day or not perfect day you do them on, they're never going to feel perfect. Right. And that's the reason why highballing is so intriguing to me, because you have to decide those things to kind of prove your mastery, prove your level of execution and performance to yourself, you know, and if you don't, you die, you just hurt yourself like really bad. And regardless of the challenge of doing them all, you know, they're going to be hard. So that day, I think the reason why it was so significant was because it was a terrible day for weather. Like it was snowing a lot that day. It was really windy. It was kind of humid. And I extended our trip. And, you know, once I committed to the one climb of the day, I kind of committed to all five. And so Ambrosia also changed order. It became second, kind of last minute. So we went from footprints straight to Ambrosia. Wrapped in Ambrosia, I put the chalk on the holds. And the sequence was basically you do the hard V11 crimp ladder to the, you know, to the Waco, which is about 20 feet up. And then from there, you do kind of this like weird V5 sequence into these crimps. And then there's a new broken section where you climb around the old jug that used to be there on these like, maybe again, like V5, V6 crimpers that are really broken and feel like they're going to break off the wall. Then you grab this horn jug and then you mash the horn jug. You're probably at 30-ish, 35 feet now. You reach up really big to this slopey, like two pad thing. It's a full sloper, but and the rock feels a little bit different there. You drop knee way down and left away from you. And then you grab this like kind of horn jug way extended and you cut feet on both of those things and get your foot up high. And so usually that sequence is pretty easy. Like you grab the horn, you grab the sloper, it sticks to your hand. It's the only like really non-in-cut hold in the entire climb. And then you drop knee and then you just go for the next hold. Well, so I got there, I was like kind of shaking out on this horn and I was feeling pretty good, but I was looking at my skin because it had just like been shredded by the climb. It's super, super coarse, that rock on that climb, which is why I didn't want to do it second, because it would have set me up, you know, with really bad skin for the rest of the day. But I got to this horn, I was shaking out and I kind of just grabbed that hold. And my immediate reaction was, what the fuck? Like, that hold is terrible. Like, it's usually like textured and gritty and like bites you and you just don't have to think about it, right? But this time I grabbed it and I was like, what the, dude, it's just like glass. It feels terrible. Put the drop knee in and just went for the next move. And I was like, that was fucked up. Like that didn't feel like perfect at all. It was more so a reaction, and my response was what I was supposed to do. But my internal feelings were, this is terrible. Like, you shouldn't do this. But I had already committed through everything. So it's like, I couldn't even have time to respond because I had already committed to it. You know, it was kind of interesting now talking through this podcast, like what was actually happening into my head, but I could totally see if that was my just one try on Ambrosia. If it felt like that, I would have tried to down climb. Probably. I would have just been like, no, fuck that, dude. Like, you know, if I had try to commit to it on the go, then of course I would react, right? But it's because I committed to it before, I was just noticing it. I was like, that was terrible. But, you know, it was more so when I topped out, I was like, that was so terrible to the point where most people would have grabbed it and walked away. But I was glad that I had been so committed to this entire day where I didn't let myself fail. I think the reason why that was hard for me though was because I didn't want to do that. Like, I didn't want to get to this place where I was so on the line where, you know, if something was not in good conditions or something was not controllable, that I, you know, like, I didn't ever want to be in a position where I kind of felt like I could walk away. But unfortunately I kind of did that day and I went for it anyway, which is great, you know. But like, you know, I had this dual kind of feeling where I was like stoked that I had overcome, but I also was like felt selfish with my friends and my partner and, you know, all those things where I kind of let myself risk that far. But anyway, that's talked about in Tint's Best Day a little bit as well. So I don't want to go too deep there, but that, yeah, anyway, all sides of it.
It's interesting because, you know, just watching you relive that and talk about it, you can see how big a moment it was. And dude, my hands are, I don't know if they're sweating because like I want to climb or because I like don't want to climb after hearing that.
Yeah.
But let's take it back to what we're talking about here. This was extreme pressure from, God, how many different angles? There's like, you know, you on a, like a sponsored athlete, you know, like a trip that, you know, was a very specific, goal. There was, danger clearly. And it, you know, what I really heard from that though, is this sinking to the, you know, your level of practice, you know, you grabbed the hold and it wasn't like you expected. And I guarantee you that drop knee and those weight on your feet were just beautiful and perfect. And yes, you had these thoughts come into your head, but you just watched them. You said, yes, this hold does not feel good. What am I going to do? What do you mean? I'm doing it. Like this is what I'm here for. I'm doing this move. I'm climbing it just like it needs to be climbed. And so I just really wanted to take it into a place that was really extreme under extreme pressure and showed that under the highest moments of pressure that what you kind of defaulted to was great technique, you know, and just moving forward. And I don't want to say silencing those thoughts. It's not that they didn't arise, that you weren't a robot. They were there, but you move forward anyways. And I think it's because you had casted that vote so many times that, you know, that's the way you reacted. And although you said that hold felt bad and you felt like you were at high risk, I actually would argue that you're right. I mean, you're right. It's too bad it didn't feel like a jug, but my hunch is actually somewhere really deep down in you, you actually made an assessment and you're like, this doesn't feel good,
but it's good enough.
Yeah. If it would have really been like, oh wait, there's like literally grease on this hold or something, there's no way I could hold it, you probably would have somehow stopped yourself deep down, but you actually just kind of made this automatic decision and look at where you are. You're telling me about it. Yeah.
I think you're right in that, like, my analysis of what's good enough is closer to the actual, is it good enough or not? And I have, my beef with my clients all the time, it's a joking beef, you know, but my beef with my clients all the time is like, your perception bias and your thresholds, your definition for your thresholds of what's possible are so far from what actually is possible. And your job as an athlete, right? Like all of you listening, your job as an athlete is to match those things, right? What you're actually capable of and what you tell yourself you're capable of. And I do think you're right in that moment. There was a lot of things that told me, hey, check it, double check it, make sure it's good enough, you know? But deep inside, I was like, it's good enough. Just go for it. You know, like for some reason, when you're putting your life on the line and you're, you know, you're paid and your friends are paid and you're on a trip and like, you know, and you're like making a movie out of it and like everything, for some reason, you think that you need to double check everything to make sure it's all really good enough, but you don't. Like everything is good enough. You know what's good enough and you do know, right? And you just have to practice enough, cast that vote to make the decisions on when it is good enough so that it just fires for you when it actually is good enough, well, you know, and you just go for it.
But that's what we're trying to do here is help people set themselves up so that they have cast those votes, that they know the training that they need to go through. And, you know, that's what these practical tips are, these encouragements to get out there and to put yourself in these situations that aren't necessarily death-defying day one, you know, to just, again, demystify, like, what, you know, what was your head doing right then? And, you know, is Tim superhuman? Like, it's like, no. Could Tim of 10 years ago have done that? No. And so it's like building up your mental game, performing under pressure is not something that you just either get born with or not. Although I don't know, Alex Honnold seems like he was kind of born with something special. But actually, I take it back. If you look at how much mileage he has under his belt, pushing his threshold just a little bit, you know, it's no big surprise that he does what he does, because do you think totally. Anyone has trained to do, like, he literally is the best person to have ever, or sorry, he literally is the most prepared to do something like solo El Cap. Like, that's what it takes. He's not just like, oh, like, I'm just going to like waltz up it. Yeah. Yeah. All right. Love it. Yeah. I do have like two things from the pros, you know, the pro tips from pros who aren't here right now that are just, you know, little comments that I feel like I wanted to leave us with. And one of them is, it's from Carlo. You know, it's funny because when we did the podcast with him, we hadn't done this podcast. We hadn't really settled on it. We didn't, you know, talk to him exactly about this, but no big surprise, Carlo knows how to execute. And so some of this came up and he really talked about focusing on that moment, making it count. It's not just about being strong enough. It's about putting it all together in that moment. And so if you want to be an expert, if you want to be a pro, if you want to separate yourself from those who are good, that's what it's about. So, you know, that's what we're here to help you do, is make it count in that moment. And, this was echoed in some time I spent with Ethan in Waco many years ago. I've never forgot this. He was doing the Machinist. It's like a long V13. And, you know, he did the moves, right? And he kind of felt the crux a few times. And he just said something along the lines of, you know, ain't nothing to it but to do it, or ain't nothing left but to do it. And just this idea was, okay, like, I can do the moves. He's physically capable, but now you have to do it. And I'm pretty sure he did within a try or two after saying that. And it was just interesting that, you know, all those physical question marks went away. So, okay, I could do the crux. This is my beta. I'm strong enough. But then actually showing up and doing it, that's the mark of a pro. And now those people we're talking about, I would argue, are great and have separated themselves from the quote unquote good. And I just wanted to make sure that we, you know, got some of those amazing things from people who have been guests on this podcast before.
Awesome.
Is that it, Tim? Do we got anything else?
Nah, I had one more, but I think we can end it there.
All right. Well,
that was great.
That was a good one. I really like the performance under pressure. I think it's what makes all sports really fun and, you know, 'cause life is like that. You can't just say like, oh, I'm nervous. Let's come back tomorrow. It's like, yeah, maybe totally. Tomorrow doesn't happen. So, get out there and test yourself and make yourself better each day.
Yeah, hopefully this helps you guys. Climbing is a awesome, you know, recreational sport for a lot of people, but we're all here performing. And, you know, hopefully if you guys really dig performing, that you guys take it seriously, care, feel the pressure, and hopefully this helps you guys navigate that pressure.
Yeah, if you like these pro tips and hearing from these pros, and if you want little summaries of the podcast, we now have a mailing list, Tim. So if you go to the kind of like podcast specialty website for Test Piece, you know, you can always go to testpiececlimbing.com to book sessions with coaches if they're not too busy, because I feel like we have no room anymore. You can go to testpiececlimbing.com, and we have a mailing list. I'll get that on the main website too. So sign up for the mailing list, so you know you can get these little bite-sized bits straight into text form too, so you don't have to always listen to our hour and a half long podcast, unless you want to hang out with us, because that's always fun too.
Nice. Sick. All right, guys, we'll see you next week.
See you next week. Thanks for tuning in. If you'd like to learn more about Test Piece Climbing, you can check us out at testpiececlimbing.com and even book a session with one of our coaches.